Dark Stories, the podcast. Season 1. Coal River, True Crime. Opening an intimate window on the raw violence, resilience, humour and dumb luck characterising the crime stories from colonial Newcastle. Case File. Johnny's Gone Mad Again. By the late 1800s, Newcastle was trading with San Francisco, South America and Europe, and the port's internationalism made it a volatile, if predictable, crime locus for drunken fighting, standover gangs, escaping convicts, prostitution, and shanghaiing. While the city administered the huge working population of miners, tradesmen, and port workers, the surrounding townships of interconnected mining towns considered themselves separate from this babble. Tough, laconic, and empathetically fair, Novocastrians praised the neighbour, the street, the pub, the church, the union, the fistfight, and the workplace to give meaning to the sometimes ruthless reality of their working lives. During the 1880s, some brutal and inexcusable crimes against women threatened the sanctity of this stoic image, as if the strident industrial noise echoing daily over the city was suddenly connected to a more shadowy malevolence.
Johnny Powell, with his wife Mary and their two young boys, had set up their stall on Stockton Beach by 1886. Their rough cottage was protected from the worst of the weather and the engulfing sands by a thick wall of scrub and trees. Johnny was a respected local, known as a stolid working man dedicated to his family and his local church. Neither drinker nor wowser, he helped neighbours and was liked by his colliery workmates until a change in the coalface rosters coincided with a more dramatic change in his character. Johnny became obsessed with the apocalyptic Old Testament tales and joined a local spiritualist group before running his own home seances, with himself as the medium and his wife as the subject. The seances evolved into a meeting space for Johnny's direct contact with God, who had enlisted him as one of his earthly prophets. Johnny could switch between brimstone preacher and overprotective parent mid-sentence, forcing Mary to send their frightened and confused boys to stay more often with sympathetic neighbours. Johnny's preaching on the streets and at work included the performance of miracles, such as when he ripped old clothes into strips before burning them in fire, with the expectation that a brand new shirt would reappear, phoenix-like, from the flames. If the material failed to transmogrify, he would claim the devil's interference. By the harsh winter of 1886, Johnny's life was a day-to-day theatre of demented preaching and quack spiritualist sessions, punctuated with moments of quiet sanity. Linking his whole sad madness was a singular obsession involving the expected arrival of a large postal order from God, which would pay his fare to America and where he would ride the great West-to-East Railway and lecture the new continent into salvation.
Despite her constant fear and anxiety about what Johnny would do next, Mary always accommodated his erratic behaviour. During early August, it seemed the worm had turned after Johnny surprised everyone by saying he felt better in his head and claimed there would be no more spiritualism for me. He laughed freely again. He went to bed without mentioning God or prophecy. He looked his wife squarely in the eye, without staring, and kissed her with plain affection. The Powells slept peacefully for the first time in memory. The churning spray of the nearby surf washed tranquilly over the beach cottage, cleansing its mess of agitation. Mary felt confident enough to imagine a better life with the old Johnny, when suddenly he erupted awake around midnight and stormed through the house shouting declarations against the devil. He eventually grabbed a broom and proceeded to strike Mary, claiming she was a serpent from hell, responsible for stealing the £150 money order God had left for him at the local post office. The ruckus woke Alfred Mullard, Johnny's friend and workmate who boarded with the Powells. Where most of his workmates had given up on Johnny and tagged him as completely cranky and beyond help, Alfred remained staunch and alert, mostly for Mary and the boys. Johnny had earlier that evening apologised for having accused Alfred and Mary of having an affair, contritely accepting it was a groundless fantasy. An agitated Johnny revisited the accusation when Alfred appeared at the back door. Mary was standing holding a block of wood, which she hit Johnny with to calm him down. As Johnny uttered muffled inanities and circled the room, Alfred distracted him with some concerned words and questions. Time enough for Mary to sneak out to long-term family friend Thomas's place.
Mary arrived at the door of their long-term friend, yelling, "Johnny has gone mad again!" Thomas woke, dressed quickly, and followed her back to the cottage. They found Alfred and Johnny warming themselves at an outdoor fire. Johnny had been quizzing Alfred about the work of the prophets, while he boasted about various absurd and impossible miracles that he could perform to prove his power. He decided on toasting a large black spider skewered on a stick, claiming to have burned the devil, and he will soon be dead. After incinerating the spider, Johnny turned everyone's attention across the river to Newcastle. He now proclaimed that the gold lights from the distant pit shafts was in fact Newcastle in conflagration, achieved through the power of his mind, although they should not worry, as God had also assured him that the city would stand anew and shining by the coming morning. After sending Mary and the boys away to neighbours, Thomas and Alfred remained with Johnny, who never rested during the night and was a constant victim to strange whims and fancies, sometimes of a very violent character. With the sun coming up over the water and Johnny still in a maniacal state of biblical threats and bizarre possibility, Thomas went to collect the now on duty Constable Sherlock. A distraught Mary was still unable to sleep, and after hearing Sherlock had been called, she returned to the cottage. On seeing his wife, the contrary Johnny embraced her fondly before dropping to his knees, kissing her hands, and praising her for returning to be his darling wife again. Outside, a laudanum-coloured sun bathed the cottage in sharp morning light, as if demanding momentary respite. Muscle heavy from no sleep, Alfred used the time for quiet ablutions, leaving Mary with Johnny and his murmurings.
Returning after a few minutes, Alfred found Mary lying on the floor, barely breathing. Blood pooled about her head and brain matter protruding from a broken skull. Johnny was standing nearby in a flustered daze. A heavy chisel from a sewing machine lay on a table nearby. Johnny impassively advised Alfred that while Mary would soon be dead, he would restore her with another miracle. A horrified Alfred ran to the road yelling for help, before his shock synchronized with his racing heartbeat, and he backtracked into the cottage where Johnny immediately attacked him with the block of wood Mary had used earlier. Alfred was knocked off balance by the blow and he fell to the ground, after which Johnny began kicking him in the ribs, calling him the devil's servant. A neighbor appeared on the threshold and he was in turn attacked by the frenetic Johnny. By the time Constable Sherlock arrived, the neighbor had bravely removed Alfred from danger while Johnny was pacing the ground, threateningly wielding a shovel. Sherlock, the neighbour, and the injured Alfred finally managed to jump, handcuff, and secure Johnny with ropes before wrestling him down the road to the police lockup.
Johnny's mania continued during the following day's inquest. He tried tearing off his handcuffs and making to escape out of a window, all the while pleading out loud for the Lord's assistance or exclaiming, "I know what I have done, but she is not dead, but only sleeping." When restraining Johnny's arms and feet failed to settle him down, the coroner ordered his removal from the courtroom. In this relative quiet, the inquest revealed a more horrific reality, one in which Mary was found lying on the floor, weltering in her life's blood, her face and head beaten beyond recognition, her mouth and upper lip black and swollen, and her right ear almost torn asunder. Johnny was indicted for murder and was transferred to Newcastle lockup the following day. After a night spent in its recently built, leather-lined padded cell, it was reported that Johnny has got over his fit of violent mania and now talks rationally. He seems to understand the peril of his position and causes no trouble in the lockup. He ate a hearty breakfast this morning and was inclined to talk. A crowd of 300 or 400 persons was gathered at the station this afternoon to see the prisoner depart by train for Maitland Jail. Towards noon he had become as rational as any ordinary person, and talked quite calmly about his two children being taken care of by his mother, and also of his little property. He persists in talking, and, from casual remarks, it seems he and his wife had differences lately, though of what nature remains uncertain. He walked quietly to the station and caused no trouble, but implicitly obeyed the directions of his custodians. Mary's death rocked the city's self-esteem. Johnny's actions questioned what essentially good people were capable of towards each other. Novocastrians fortified themselves by helping the two orphaned boys. They reassured themselves as more facts came out, suggesting Johnny was utterly mad rather than evil. But just 6 months after Mary's murder, another violent domestic crime was to unravel the community's fragile confidence.
Ms. Harris was a domestic servant at a sailor's boarding house on Scott Street, run by the infamous Mrs. Minchin, when she met Charles Harris, 10 years her senior. He proposed marriage and a partnership in his own modestly profitable boarding house just up the road. For the unfortunate Ms. Harris, her industrious and quietly inoffensive husband revealed himself to be a lush who transformed into a perfect madman on the drink. Charles would spend most nights drinking with the boarders and much of the day sleeping it off. When he began suffering from delirium tremens, Ms. Harris found herself running a business as well as waiting on her husband more than a wife should. Things came to a head in January 1887 when Charles justified a fortnight's binge after he had fallen down a narrow staircase drunk at Christmas and injured his leg. After being twice restrained by lodgers for lashing out violently at Ms. Harris, his wife took him to Sydney for specialist help. His rehabilitation included being weaned off alcohol by drinking smaller doses each successive night. This decreased the frequency of the delirium tremens attacks, but it also produced an outbreak of the blues, a term Charles had picked up from black American sailors. Despite this, he was recovering until a petty argument ended with a lodger needing wounds dressed at the hospital, and with Charles back on the bottle to calm himself down. The following night, a more sheepish Charles joined Ms. Harris in bed at around 1 a.m. after their live-in servant, Sarah, complained of hearing someone trying to break in through a downstairs door and window. Just before dawn, screams issued from the Harris's bedroom, followed by Ms. Harris running out into the hallway with the top half of her nightdress aflame. Ms. Harris knocked loudly at the servant's door, but Sarah was alarmed and refused to open the door. The suffering woman rushed into the boarder's sleeping apartment and fell prostrate on the floor. Some of the men rushed to her assistance and wrapped blankets round her writhing form to extinguish the flames. When police constables arrived, Charles was sitting on a chair with his head leaning on the toilet table, under which was a large pool of blood. On him they found that he had inflicted 2 deep gashes in his throat from which blood was flowing freely. A washing basin was in front of him, into which a quantity of his life's blood had trickled, and this clearly shows that he was determined to end his career. A kerosene lamp was found in the sleeping apartment in a broken condition. At the hospital, Charles' wounds were stitched up. Despite efforts to alleviate her torture, Ms. Harris lingered on in agony until 5 o'clock the following morning, when death relieved her from the troubles of this life.
If Johnny was broken by madness, Charles was stewed in an alcoholic soup. Both men avoided the drop on grounds of insanity, traversing any legal determination of Mary and Ms. Harris being murdered with malice aforethought by their husbands. Charles was sentenced to 5 years jail, while Johnny remained a long-term resident at the Gladesville Insane Asylum. While Johnny's insanity was evidently clear-cut, Charles's verdict hinged on contemporary medical wisdom, suggesting that mind blankness from delirium tremens occurred only at night, usually after 8 p.m. This was despite clear evidence that Charles had splashed kerosene over his wife before igniting her clothes, contradicting his claim that a bed lamp had accidentally fell on her. As a perversion of nature and social order, madness counterintuitively inferred guilt on both victims. They were unfortunate vessels for the demons, uncertainties, and inabilities that haunted and overcame their actions. Charles's counsel, for example, argued that his client not only suffered the loss of his business and livelihood, but most tragically, he lost the one woman who loved him more than anything in her own life. It was not directly their faults, but their sex and the circumstances somehow made their deaths inevitable. A few months after the trial, Messrs. Edwards and Gorick were far less effusive about their client's excusable mental state when Charles reneged on a deal to sell Scott Street and his business to pay their legal fees, instead using his frail mental state to avoid signing the contract. While both these murders were unique, they did question conventional expectations of male domestic kinship.
For men like Johnny Greenwood, the violence inherent in this was an unfortunate but necessary side effect. When he arrived in Newcastle by train, after hunting down his runaway wife to a rented room in Brook Street, the only issue on his mind was how much of a beating she deserved. 35-year-old Fanny Greenwood left Mount Kembla with the couple's young daughter after one too many beatings from Greenwood. For Greenwood, it wasn't so much that Fanny had left, rather that he hadn't decided if she could or not. A couple of weeks before she escaped, he refused to take her to the hospital after she attempted suicide, claiming it was a selfish attempt at avoiding looking after their child, which she did find difficult. After alighting the train at Civic Station, Greenwood found Brook Street where, he would later claim, a naked Fanny was mixing it up with two men in bed. Fanny's sexual adventurousness had first drawn Greenwood to the good time girl, who enjoyed dancing, drinking, and male companionship. After the birth of their child, Fanny became increasingly maudlin and sexually frigid, proof for Greenwood that she was sleeping around. After arriving in Brook Street, Greenwood's first chance to publicly reassert himself came when Fanny refused to leave with him after drinks with neighbours. When Fanny wanted to stay, Greenwood called her a cow, threatening that if you don't come out, I'll rip you open. Fanny belligerently remained to finish her bottle. When she returned home, Greenwood met her at the front door where he fiercely grabbed and dragged her by the hair into the house. While she sprawled about screaming on the kitchen floor, Greenwood pulled out his pocket knife and viciously stabbed her twice in the neck before their daughter threw herself on top of her mother, screaming,
"Daddy, don't kill Mummy!"
Greenwood left Fanny to rush out and find help while he gathered up her clothes and lit them in a backyard bonfire. On being arrested, Greenwood told the police he was sorry he didn't finish her off, but at least he would be rid of her for a while. At the trial, the treating doctor explained how Fanny had barely escaped death from the incised wound on the right side of the neck, about 2 inches long and between a quarter and half an inch in depth, downwards and forwards. The cut had been made from the ear towards the windpipe, and had the wound been a little deeper, it might have proved fatal. Greenwood was sent down for 5 years at Maitland Jail, although he would spend half that sentence in the ferocious dog-eat-dog hell of Darlinghurst Jail. Fanny and her mother remained in Newcastle and became local vagrants, living hand-to-mouth and sleeping in town paddocks, laneways, and doss houses when Fanny could afford it. Unable to keep regular work, she occasionally slept with men for grog or accommodation. In December 1891, she was found dead on the floor of an Islington boarding house. The cause of death was kidney disease from too much alcohol. The death notice that made the rounds in the many state newspapers defined her as the victim of a brutal domestic stabbing, now reduced to a tawdry symbol of what happens to women allowed alcohol. Her death coincided with the newspaper syndication of an Anthony Trollope novel in which a minor character called Fanny avoids a bad marriage to an unscrupulous priest by the name of Greenwood.
For men like Russell, the bravado of fiction paled against the fierce and spontaneous reality of gaining your street reputation. Russell was a young tough who moved to Newcastle from Sydney with larrikin aspirations and pointed shoes. By 1891, he had learned to take a punch and was running small errands for southern crooks. He was also romantically set on seeing a fine-looking Newcastle girl called Patience. Unfortunately, the lusty Patience had given up on Russell as their nights out had increasingly ended with him strutting like the daddy of them all, intent on starting a ruckus. When he began telling Patience how she should dress, Patience decided she was no bit of muslin and definitely no larrikin's donna. After one too many arguments, she stayed home from their regular Saturday night at Cook's Dancing Saloon. Russell spent the following day drinking to get narked with some high-heeled mates before heading to Patient's house to sort her out. On hearing his drunken banging and yelling at her front door, Patience wisely took his arm to walk around the quiet Sunday afternoon city streets. When they reached the corner of Brown and King Streets, Russell suddenly seized her wrist and she alleges drew a revolver, pointed it at her, threatening to shoot her. She broke from his grasp and rushed off, but immediately heard two reports. The noise drew the attention of a patrolling constable who took Thomas into custody for drunkenness. While he slept off the drink in a cell, the sergeant and a young man named Pitt found a revolver, a pocket knife, and handkerchief near the spot where the shots were alleged to have been fired. Russell was discharged at trial after Pitt, who may have been out and about with Russell on the Sunday, stated that he was near at the time, and from what he saw, he believed that Russell fired into the air. Russell heeded the judge's advice and left Patience alone, although Patience claimed brief notoriety by publicly snubbing him in the dance saloons for a few weeks after.
Dance saloons like Cook's and the Central played popular sing-alongs and dance tunes. They were a merry-go-round of romance and heartbreak for the city's youth. It was where Matthew first met Miss Murchie. After 6 months of keeping company, the 19-year-old, fresh-faced Matthew was still smitten with the free-spirited and cheeky 16-year-old house servant, his first sweetheart. Their relationship reached a crossroads when Matthew received a job in Sydney. He wanted Miss Murchie to marry him and to go, but she had cold feet and waylaid his enthusiasm by claiming that her parents wouldn't approve. The more she avoided his proposal, the more jealous and fixated Matthew became with the male attention that Miss Murchie always received in the dance halls. It ended with Matthew and Miss Murchie exchanging face slaps on a Thursday night while the band played the ever-popular Walking in the Zoo. A week following their altercation, the couple met for their regular Thursday night when Matthew asked to leave Cook's early. The couple walked together along Hunter Street as far as Jubilee Lane. He told her that he was leaving for Sydney within the month. When she cut Matthew short and asked him to change the subject, the usually timid Matthew aggressively warned her that she should not go to that dancing place anymore. She said he could not stop her. She felt something strike her in the left eye and saw something like sparks of fire before her face. Then she fell down and remembered no more till she found herself in the hospital. Matthew had purchased a new revolver that morning from a Hunter Street jeweller. The jeweller later recalled how the cash-strapped Matthew had paid the balance by pawning a piece of cheap gold attached to a chain given to him by his parents. The doctors treating Miss Murchie in hospital would report that the bullet's trajectory went through the eyeball in a direction slightly upwards and to the right. It remained lodged under the skin of her right temple for some harrowing time until the surgeons took out her eye to safely remove it. The operation left Miss Murchie wearing a heavy bandage until she found a high-quality and affordable second-hand German glass eye, hand-blown with an almost identical colour to the one removed.
Matthew was ashamed and remorseful at his packed-out court trial. Character witnesses described him as the son of a respectable Hamilton storekeeper who had completed an apprenticeship but had lost his way after going to dance halls. When asked about slapping Miss Murchie in the face, Matthew asserted that she had slapped him first after he had made accusations about her flirting and dancing with other boys. On the day of the shooting, Matthew bought the revolver and headed straight to the back of the Castlemaine Brewery, where he tested it out shooting at sparrows with some mates. He had 100 shells, but was sure the chamber was empty when he met up with her that night. Matthew went on to explain how he was anxious about leaving for Sydney without an answer from Miss Murchie. He had given money to her that afternoon to buy new dancing shoes and a bouquet. He hoped they would marry and move to Sydney, regardless of her parents' disapproval. "I told her I was going to Sydney on the Sunday afternoon. She asked me what dancing hall we should go to, the Central or Cook's. I said either. I took her to the dancing hall, left for some time and returned. We danced and left for her home. When we got to the lane near her house, I said, "Well, darling, I have got a revolver in my pocket. I will have a bit of sport when I get to Sydney." I started to click it. After I had clicked it about 4 times, it went off. Miss Murchie's memory of the night was almost a complete blank. She could not recall being there and had to be told there was a bullet lodged between skin and skull. Hospital nurses noticed she seemed pleased to see Matthew when he visited before being arrested. The pair had even kissed. She was sure that while she and Matthew had kept company, marriage was never a real consideration. The jury found the shooting was a moment of accidental incompetence, a boy playing at being a man. The case was discharged and Matthew moved to Sydney, leaving Miss Murchie behind with a false eye and a large scar and a reputation as being a salacious girl who had brought trouble on herself. 2 years after the trial, she was an unmarried, single mother living in the coal village of Lambton. She had woken to find her young baby dead after sleeping over Lane. A local newspaper's small column box report of the accidental death noted her sad past. It appeared adjacent to a large quarter-page advertisement showing a drawing of two large-headed babies smiling and fighting over an opened biscuit box. Directly above them, in large filigree advertising type, were the words, "If the babies could talk, they would urge their mothers to use Hardman's biscuits."
If the rifle dissolved distance on the frontier, the revolver's portability contrived for itself a menacing aura of random and immediate urban violence. As a mass-produced everyman tool, it created a world of professionals, amateurs, and barely competent users. Persuasive counsels would use these distinctions to question a shooter's criminal culpability and turn the mechanical act of pulling a trigger into a fraught, entangled flash of momentary madness, a cruel joke, sport gone wrong, or even youthful folly. Any cause and effect linking the shooter, weapon, and victim became an arguable space of uncertainty and ambiguity. For all that, guns proved no different to knives, kerosene, or fists when it came to judging domestic violence against women in late 18th century Newcastle. Regarded as slippery, weak, and unstable, the passive female nature attracted and invited erratic male responses of madness, jealousy, loneliness, or lack of self-control. While the courts acknowledged them mothers and victims, the women were, by the unexamined sexual standards of nature's design, implicit triggers of their own fates.
Thank you for listening. This Dark Stories podcast has been narrated by David
and Elizabeth.
For more information, please search on www.darkstories.com.au or please visit hunterlivinghistories.com or join the author's Facebook page by searching for the Facebook group On Ground Level. If you enjoyed this episode, please like, share and subscribe to receive future episodes. Until next crime, this case is closed.